Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. The following program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. At Whole Foods Market, we offer premium products without premium prices. Our everyday value items are free of artificial preservatives, colors, flavors, sweeteners, and hydrogenated fats. Priced competitively to average supermarket prices, the 365 Everyday Value brand offers food that meets our strict quality standards. Compare our peanut butter, canned beans, and cereals to the other guys. You'll see what we're talking about. Visit one of our six Manhattan stores in Tribeca, Bowery, Union Square, Chelsea, Columbus Circle, or the Upper West Side. Open 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. For more information, visit www.wholefoodsmarket.com.
Trying to come in too early, weren't
you? I was, a little eager beaver over here. Welcome to this afternoon's program of Unfiltered. This is your co-host, Aaron Fitzpatrick.
With Brian DeMarco. Good to be here with a full house today, huh?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, this is our 97th show as well. Broadcasting live today, what is it, the 31st of January. So feels a little bit more like end of March.
It's very autumnal slash springy today.
Springy. The birds are chirping. Yeah.
I'm wearing a short sleeve shirt. I'm feeling very...
You are. Little reggae short sleeve shirt and some green flash brew.
Yeah.
Say you're already there.
I'm already here.
Yeah.
I've been here. So
We'll kick off today's program a little bit of news.
What you got for us today?
Well, I was reading this morning about this state liquor map that New York is putting out, the SLA, which all of us who've worked in the industry know it is one of the most grueling processes to go through, especially in Manhattan, to get approval for your licensing for beer or wine or liquor. So the
it's not just on premise that it's a pain. It's for even when you want to bring new wines in the country, they're the federal level of the liquor authority is very strident and stringent on the way that they actually review labels, alcohol content, and you can't have any potentially subversive sexual or innuendo that this product will actually get you drunk. So there's a lot of weird things, like you can't say what the product does. Drink this and you'll have a good time. We can't say that.
Right.
So it's like it's therapeutic wine.
Highly controlled.
Highly controlled.
Yeah.
So, but what's going on locally?
Well, the SLA is getting ready to launch an interactive map, which will plot each and every bar licensed in the city, as well as all pending applications and the violations bars have logged in the past, to give residents and community boards sort of a scope of how to keep track of local bars and clubs in different neighborhoods. So it's sort of an answer to growing complaints from residents who believe the bars are taking over their block, which has been a huge source of contest for the past decade, certain areas in the city, for sure.
But I think there's two stories there. One, it looks like a great map for bar hopping.
Well, it costs $75,000 to make this map. So you.
Whoa, hey. We are recording live, you can tell. Lucy was trying to, have her way with a dishwasher.
Touche.
Didn't work out so well.
She got thrown across the room into a pile of glasses.
But I think the other thing that's interesting about that map, or the proposed idea of this map, is that it allows you to really track how many liquor licenses are within residential areas, and you can actually see where they, if there's a school or a church, I think there's specific, violations or rules about how close you can be to any of these structures. So I imagine that it's just another way to spend our tax money where...
Well, yes. Yeah. It was paid for using a special budget appropriation dedicated to investments in information technology. So money saved by using public data and existing databases. So they claim it's a great value given the amount of content that's been developed.
Wow, well, that iPhone's loaded with information.
Yep, that's right. I did not memorize this piece of news.
So any other local goodies for us?
Well, we have two local goodies in the studio today.
Ooh,
so
do tell.
Wanted to welcome you in. This is Omar Hernandez and Camille Broderick. Hello.
Hello, guys. How are you?
Hello. Thank you for having us here.
Definitely. This is your second time, isn't it, Camille?
It is. It's always a treat to be here. Thank you.
So Camille and Omar are joining us today from Hotel Americano. So would love to hear a little bit more about this project, this new hotel.
Well, Hotel Americano is it's a relatively new hotel. I guess it's in that category of slowly opening its doors. It never had its official opening. I think Omar can tell you a little bit more about that. But it is an absolutely beautiful property, and it's the first of its owners. They're from Mexico, and they first this is their first property in the United States, actually. And it's located right in Chelsea in the heart of the gallery area, and right near the High Line and accessible to the West Side Highway and the park there. So it's just a beautiful location and relatively small boutique hotel. I believe there's
56 rooms.
56 rooms, okay.
Yeah. The Hotel Americano is a brainchild of this group called the Habitat Group in Mexico. And it's a wonderful property because it was thought out to be a fresh voice in the New York scene with the idea of having, 56 rooms, very, very well appointed and well designed and great aesthetics, but also value to it, which is something that's pretty big these days.
Yeah, about hard to find.
The whole value content ratio, it determines a lot about your business going to go. So they really been one of the first pioneers worldwide of design boutique hotels. Mm-hmm. And everything is tied in. I mean, they're trying to create a brand national, like in the States. And we part of the philosophy is that we want to embrace the new culture of value, simplicity, and definitely content. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of what we stand for. And we are there. I mean, we are pioneering in an area that was sort of like unofficially became like the Skid Row of New York City for a minute.
Sure, yeah.
So now we're turning into more of a cultural point of reference, a destination. So we're very excited to be part of the scene and try to get a slice of the city as well.
Well, I was telling Camille when I came to visit and have dinner at the hotel a couple of weeks ago that I had stayed at the Habitat in Mexico City about 6 years ago. And she was telling me that you were going to be opening on the roof, I guess come springtime. And I had gone to the Habitat roof when I was staying there, and they were streamlining some cool videos and movies, and there was just a whole sort of very lively, vibrant scene on the rooftop. So I can totally see the value add for the addition to the New York hotel landscape. Yeah.
I mean, the rooftop is sort of like in New York City becoming the biggest commodity anybody can have when you open a hotel, especially now. Mm-hmm. Like if you don't have a rooftop, your chances of succeeding, it just goes down for like 20% to 25% or 30. I don't know what it is.
I think the rooftop is, allows people to feel like it's open air, even though their room may be the size of, like if you go to a Neen Schrager hotel, he was one of the first to talk about this communal space and having, there's two concepts. One, never leave the property. So they have great hotels that have great restaurants and great bars. So people felt inclined to stay. And then they had communal space. Like at the Hudson Hotel, they have this outdoor space where they have the library room where there's a great pool table. And so people feel inclined to stay. And then the last three or four summers, I think it started with the place on Fifth Avenue, Aaron. It was like the rooftop where they would actually give you blankets or the Snuggie,
like 347 Fifth or something
exactly. And you would go up there, and I mean, the drinks were $10, it wasn't inexpensive, but everyone wanted to be seen and wanted to be on the rooftop. So,
yeah, I mean, that's for us there. I mean, we had the views on the west side are like, it's like some of the waste. The only issue is the sort of the air rights that you have to kind of try to find when you're trying to open a hotel. But for us, we coming up in the scene this spring with a beautiful program we're curating every month, starting in end of March. So we're giving every month an artist or somebody within the neighborhood that sort of has a sort of a clout and is looking to do something different to curate the content for us.
That's great.
So that ties in with what would be our wine program and where we, what cocktails are we going to serve, what kind of food are we going to be offering. So all of that, it's very, we're trying to be very democratic about it. Like, mm-hmm. we're trying to bring the community to tell us a bit what works for mm-hmm. them, you mm-hmm. see? So that's sort of like...
What would be the, you know, what are you thinking about charging for rooms, like on average?
Well, I mean, ideally, I mean, we have what they call the rack rates, and they start usually around $350 and up, but given the time in the everything is very versatile now. So you have to really adapt and very dynamic. So at this point, you still can get rates for $250, you know, as we speak, which is a very good deal in mm-hmm. New York City, in mm-hmm. downtown New York, which is competitive to with the neighbor hotels as well. So $250, $260 is almost like the lowest you can get nowadays, and you get a good deal as well. So I think that's sort of what we're looking into. Prices in hotel rooms right now are a very tricky thing, believe it or not. And I'm just saying this, I'm making myself in trouble now, but you can call a hotel right now and get a room for a certain rate, but then at the same time you go online and you'll find the same room in the same hotel, maybe $100 less.
Right, right.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I actually understand this quite well. It's the same way the airlines operate, is if someone, you know, a consolidator comes and buys a block of rooms, then those are rooms the hotel does not have to sell, because the consolidator now owns that inventory. So it's like me as an importer, if I sell wine to Michigan, Michigan owns that wine. I don't care what, if he can't sell it, that's not really my problem. But, I mean, it is my problem ultimately, you know, in the bigger picture. But in the immediate Tuesday night, if the operator has bought, call it Expedia, if they've bought 20 rooms and only three of people have checked in, that's not your fault. Expedia owes you the money regardless. And so even if it isn't a discount rate.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think in New York City, I mean, especially the last couple of years with the amount of people that are coming in now, like the tourism has grown so fast. So now there's definitely more demand, more competition. Everybody's opening a hotel. So mm-hmm. I think the key for us there being a destination still is to sort of like set the tone for the neighborhood. I mm-hmm. mean, that we feel like that's part of like what we are trying to accomplish at this point in the game. It's just nobody's around yet in terms of another hotels. But right. I think if we're offering a great product, especially in the food and beverage department, with the quality of the food, our wine list, which I think Camille can educate us.
I was just about to ask. I mean, if you're going to try to draw people over to Wells Chelsea, there's no subways over there yet.
Yeah.
And the High Line's nice, but it's a walking thing.
Yeah.
Camille, what am I going to go eat and drink on West 27th Street? Tell me the story over there.
Well, there's quite a selection, Brian, but I know you're particular. So we'll,
very particular. But.
No, that's actually, I think, what makes the property really special at this point in time, because it's it does have a real international following already with the ownership. And then yet it's really trying to find its locals right there. And being in Chelsea, you do have a lot of regular clientele in that neighborhood. It's quite a community over there. And then the artist community is there too. And then those who travel for that artist community. So it's a real interesting network of people. And then it's funny, I'll be in the dining room and I'll be serving wine and I can see this older couple from the Upper East Side who sit down, they come and they visit because they're looking at the artwork downtown. And then right next to them are young travelers from Mexico or wherever, and it just seems to fit. The space is really beautifully designed. I think the architecture has a very warm yet very comfortable feeling to it. And again, the food's like that too. It's excellent food, but it's executed in a really kind of comfortable way. Even the napkins are kind of this kind of country like linen. It just seems like
they're nice texture to
everything. And it's just very comfortable. And that's hard to
tell me about
make
some of the dishes. Like, what are some of the more popular dishes that people are grooving on now?
Well, it's interesting because being Mexican, they take that role, and then they have real classically trained chefs in the kitchen. So again, everyone knows that the people are combining different culinary titles to food, when I think at the end of the day, people just want something tasty, and that's what they're delivering. So they have things from tostados to a beautiful kind of steak frites. So it's it's a good range. And again, I think they're really trying to make people happy, both the regular international clientele and then someone who just wants to come in for even just a snack or something quick if they're stopping by.
And Camille is a sommelier at the Hotel Americano, so I want to clarify that for our listeners. And Omar, what is your role?
I'm actually the hospitality consultant for the property.
Ooh, nice.
So I'm like the buffer. That's uh-huh. what they call me.
Okay, okay.
I help everybody to get whatever they need to get done. And, mm-hmm. and the idea is to create some product that's cohesive on every end. And it takes, and it's one of the things now, like, takes every part of the project to work together to actually make it work. Like mm-hmm. that there is no way around that. Right. So I'm there
to... All things have to speak to each other, yeah.
They have to, especially now where, like, visions are shared and everything has to be really agree upon.
Well, mm-hmm. tie in. They have some tie in some mm-hmm. way.
Yeah, so I think for us, going back to the point that I think is important about the wine that we're talking and food, I mean, for us, is that our chef... his name is John Buenconsejo. He comes from the Lion. He was the opening chef at the Lion. So he has very clear his French techniques. But the whole idea in the vision of the ownership, especially one of the owners who was very key on, it was to keep the food very edited. Mm-hmm. Too much information is too much. Mm-hmm. You see, so about now the trend to the healthy, lighter, pure with perfect technique, that's kind of like what we're looking for, simple,
yeah,
without too much fuss or
and the wine list, which we can finally discuss its beauty, is the fact that it's so simple and has so much great value in it. That's kind of the best part about the list. It's relatively short, it's readable, you can kind of get a little bit of everything. It's more than half the list is under $100, surprisingly, even for that market and for the location. But a couple others have worked on the list and started the list. I only joined the property about 4 months ago. However, the food and beverage director, they really wanted to make the list something unique and offered great value, which it definitely does for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was well edited, but with a couple gems in there too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the idea we were talking earlier is that we had an opening sort of like program, and then we are listening to what our clientele wants. Mm-hmm. And just was mentioning earlier that, you know, the whole biodynamic movement and the organic movement is big on that community. And it's something that you learn once you are there.
Hmm.
You can come out with a whole list organic before you open.
Sure.
And you learn that there actually doesn't speak to anyone. But mm-hmm. now we're learning that slowly there's more growing, especially in our neighborhood, the creative type and people that come as a regular daily, they want that.
Especially if you're gonna eat there as a regular, you want to know that the chicken is free range. You want to know that the beef is grass fed. You want to know that the seafood is caught in a certain manner. And I think that that's really key because, you know, anyone can cater to a crowd on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. Anyone can be busy on Saturday night. And I think I guess the question I have for Camille is let's get back to the wine, which is kind of our focus anyway,
sure.
is tell me about who's drinking there on Tuesday night and who's drinking there on Saturday night. Like, tell me, or is it the same customer?
That's a good question. It gets you thinking because the place is still relatively young. Some people are still discovering the property itself, but it is interesting because you have travelers there on Saturdays, but then you also just have weekenders. So I think you nailed it. I think it's the same person. A Saturday night can be a Tuesday night. A mm-hmm. Wednesday night can be a Friday night. It's you kind of never know who's going to walk through the door. And again, the list is, for example, the wines by the glass, the whites, we serve an incredible, Chablis, from a Magnum. That's our highest end white by the glass, which is, mm-hmm. it's beautiful. And I mean, it's just, if you're going to put an expensive wine, white wine, I mean, a Magnum white Burgundy, I mean, that's kind of the best it can get.
That's it.
That's where it's at.
And then the lower end is, I mean, we want to bring in some local wines, which we don't have on the list yet, but that's one of my first initiatives. We have some great wines out east, and we should represent our great state of New York here. But then we have this great white Grenache that's delicious and it's inexpensive and again great value, but it's fun. It has a nice varied range, which also kind of goes to the the different clientele that come in the door.
Great. And the average by the glass, for if you're drinking by the glass, what are the ranges like? Can I get anything below $10 a glass?
No, sir.
that's not that surprising these days. That's not that surprising these days.
I'll tell you, yes, the zip code again. I don't think that's possible. No. Yeah. But there is one that's 11, and that's awesome.
But you still can get a bottle for under 40.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's your highest by the glass, and what is it?
That's the white Burgundy. Yeah. Yeah, that's actually even our reds. We did have a Bordeaux, but we're actually changing it now. But the highest is the...
Chablis.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, we'll taste a few wines after this short break and also hear about the new property that Hotel Americano Group is opening in Baja. And then Brian can share his knowledge about the genealogy of California wines from having started in Mexico. Yeah.
Wow. Let's wait for that.
Huh? Yeah, please. Stay tuned, folks.
Somewhere beyond the sea, she's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing. It's far beyond a star, it's near beyond the moon. I know beyond the shore, we'll kiss just as before. Happy we'll be beyond the sea, and never again I'll go sailing.
You are listening to Unfiltered on the Heritage Radio Network, heritageradionetwork.com, and this is Unfiltered, broadcasting live on Tuesdays at 4 p.m.
From Roberta's.
So speaking of white wines by the glass, here we have a little Bonchi Verdicchio, which is new to...
Well, it's not new to the market. It's new for our book. It's quite... delicious. I don't know if you think it is, but I think it's quite delicious. And
it's delicious.
I second that.
I like when you slurp on the air. It's always delicious. But this wine is widely considered the benchmark for Castellesi from the Marche. This is all organically grown fruit, all hand picked and hand harvested. And the way that these guys do it is like it's almost open top fermenters because mm-hmm. the winery is woefully out of date, which now is like almost kitsch.
Okay,
like you go back to it, and it's like they're like,
how these guys do this?
How'd you get that barrel? It's like, well, we've had it from the beginning. And it's like we just keep sending a little man in to clean it, and so it's really interesting. And that when I first got Verdicchio into my book, I always thought it had to be value driven, and I realized there's no middle. It's got to be either $8. Or $20, because this is the old school people believe in, you know, a certain kind of quality at a certain level, and this is the higher range. And we have other wines that I think are a bit lower, but don't have the consistency or the viscosity. Omar, what do you think about this wine?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, this to me sounds like it could be the next wine for the summer.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. The bright acidity.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's
good. I mean, ceviche just sort of screams out for that.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah. It's like this. We were talking about earlier about rosés for the summer and everything, but I think that this is a great pairing for any of the dishes that we have seafood based. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But also the feeling of it is very it's fragrant, but also it has it's delicate. So I think
right, and it also has a pedigree, which is really key, because a lot of places, like, you know, Camille, you know, when you worked at the Monkey Bar, a lot of places, you know, if it was by the glass, you were selling it by the varietal, which I know you sold a lot of wines by varietal.
Yeah.
It was really irrelevant almost who the producer was. But this is really on the bottle list. So, you know, if it's, this would be well under $100 a bottle, but when you give it to a customer, it's got that sort of feel of, you know, of what they're buying. Mm. Whereas I know a lot of wines that are, you know, great, and they may pop out of the glass or by the glass. You put them on the bottle list, so when there's sort of this there's not the ooh and the ah when you drop the bottle at the table, that, you know, a sommelier is like doing a screw top, and they're like, oh, well, that was really helpful.
Yeah.
Thanks for opening the bottle for me. You know, but I think it goes a long way that, you know, like Bordeaux, I think you and I have talked about it before, where you couldn't really serve a Bordeaux in a screw top. It just wouldn't make sense.
No, I don't think we've broken that barrier completely, but I think it starts with fresh young white wines, I think. But when it comes to Italian whites, I cannot be more of an advocate for how fabulous there are so many great white Italian wines that so many people just kind of forget and look over when they go to just a Pinot Grigio, and then there's just so many layers. And when you get something this vibrant and so light with so much flavor, I think that's really hard to get in a white wine, and that has that great foundation, but yet it drinks like it's so young and has just so much going on, but then it just kind of dissipates and it's and
very
and
trademark of the region as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we know how to pick them, right, Aaron?
That's right. That's right. That's right. Well, before we move on to the second wine too, do you want to speak a little bit about what's on the horizon for the hotel group?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, actually, we're coming up with a beautiful project next month in the region of Baja, and that is called Hotel Endemico.
Endemico.
And
okay.
it's an eco hotel, which is everything is being thought out to be very, everything that we used product for construction, everything is very local, but also the way the design of the hotel, it was oriented to actually have a very low impact in the uh-huh. in the environment.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that it's at the foothills of the Baja region, which is the wine country, that I guess we're going to go over and educate.
Not in detail.
It's emerging. It's emerging. There's definitely been more news about Baja in the past 2 years than ever before. So,
but I mean, Baja's like it's incredibly expensive to have. Actually, let's go back. It's incredibly cheap and incredibly expensive to have a good time in Baja.
Yes.
I mean, I stayed at Palmia, the one and only.
Of course.
And it was amazing. But we ate at the Jean George restaurant. We ate, you know, there was a golf cart that picked me up in front of my door at every moment. And they were in my pocket every second of the day. Everything we did came at a cost. But then when you step outside and go into the town, you can go to a local, you know, taqueria, and, you know, you can kill yourself for $10 trying to eat. And it's amazing. There's so much diversity in Baja. But, I mean, the region itself is growing dramatically.
Yeah, that's one of the visions for the group, is to try to we're sort of like the friendly hotel that's not gonna kill you if you stay there. You could stay probably under $200 for sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? That's great.
Yeah. So it's gonna be, the whole approach to it is to create the eco-friendly movement in Mexico, which is huge, and now it's growing more. So the whole plan for every other property from this point on, it will be always eco-green. Which is part of the whole vision for the company.
So there's a hotel group that you are their consultant?
Yeah, I'm the consultant. I'm the opening consultant for this property in New York, and they're planning to open a couple other properties in the country. So they're moving very fast to trying to make a point with this brand. With
right,
hotel
identify
American.
The markets. And
so,
then,
so yeah. Do you live yeah. in a hotel room?
Actually, that's there's the last place I want to ever sleep. Believe it or not, I mean, it's sort of like I can't even think. When you work in hotels, you appreciate your own, mm-hmm. you know, your own bed, whatever yeah. that is, and yeah. wherever you live.
Mm-hmm. Well, come on, if you, the Four Seasons has been selling beds for like 10 years now. I mean, that's a pretty comfortable bed.
Well, it's true. It's true. I think it's just the fact that you kind of know the whole history behind every single thing that happens in that room.
Oh, no. Don't sell me.
That's the truth of the business. I mean, there's... When you work in the business, it's the same thing with wine. I mean, you can drink wine as much as you want, but maybe there are things that you don't want to deal with in the wine business. So that's what we do.
Yeah, like, you don't think about those if you're a consumer. You know about the what right. happens oh, in the God. Back. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So. No, but hotel business is fun. I mean, it's you get to interact and you get to see where the culture is going. You know, you are sort of like a radar. Because you get everything, whatever's going on. And people, when they're eating and festing and having fun, they kind of express how they feel. So I think if we kind of become a little bit of a voice for what's happening in town.
And the ownership have been really open to ideas, and they're constantly asking for feedback because they know that that's the way for it to kind of grow and to really work with its clientele and the environment.
But feedback within a certain bandwidth of what you want to do and staying true to the theme, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They're open to the changes of the wine list. They want to make things work, and it's good because it's not this huge corporate entity that you have to go through these channels to make change happen. It can happen as soon as you are empowered to implement it.
Yeah. Right. And I think the sense of ownership too, like going back to almost like you were saying earlier about things done the old-fashioned way using the advantage of technology and social media and so forth and so forth. But I think the sense of ownership has to go back to the hands of the owners. You mm-hmm. know, like it used to be.
Yeah, you have to have someone steering that ship. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And it's sort of like in this time and age in how things are. I think every owner has to get back to that old model of really looking after your business.
Yes.
I mean, there is no way around it.
No, there's
but I think you said something earlier that still resonates with me, and I thought I'd circle back to it, but I will now. Is it that you were sort of how, you know, your job is sort of the arbiter of keeping things within the vision. And I see so many times, I eat out for a living. I mean, everybody here that we're sitting with basically goes out for a living. And we are critical about certain things, and we'll let other things slide. You know, you may be, you know, more critical about service, Camille, than others, because you know you're practicing, you know, your art, and you want people to get, you know, want it to be efficient and fast and friendly.
You can't turn it off. It's sometimes a curse.
Right. So, but sometimes you go someplace and you see something that's totally out of place, or that has no reason to be there. And I just want to, and I always just. I either try to ignore it or I usually can't turn it off. And so, Omar, I see how you know, you're a very specific man as well. You know, how do you keep, you know, the trendy from not being yesterday's news?
Yeah,
I mean, like you put it up and it looked cool this week, and all of a sudden, like, oh, you're still working with that,
yes.
huh?
Yeah, exactly.
You're still wearing that. Boy, I think, In my business, I mean, it's a very you have to be open. I mean, I think that's the key, because you start with an idea and you have a vision and you sort of create a whole protocol to trying to implement that vision. And then as you go, and people, I mean, at the end of the day, our patrons and our guests are who dictates who you are. I mean, that's really what it is. So I make an effort to really be open to suggestions and mm-hmm. see what the ownership wants to do with that property. But I think more importantly, I listen to what our guests and people that are there are saying and what they want. And I think my responsibility is always to make sure that the ownership is aware of that. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes their executive decision to say, you know what, we're going to go for it or not.
So do you think that half the places in town, they believe that people dressed in Club Monaco outfits, eating, serving tuna tartare on a little small round plate. That's happening in hundreds of restaurants right now.
And I think, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think the last 3 years.
The vision in my head is very clear.
That's a formula that's sort of been around for the last 3 years due to, you know, the economic turned down. And I think if people are trying to go for more like the tapas, little eatery, and it's a formula. Everything, the same thing when you go to see this whole prohibition look and the retro. Mm-hmm. Right. And right. Something like, if you ask me, Omar, what do you think? I said, well, that was 10 years ago when Motto started in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I said, that was the original to me. Now everything progresses and evolves. So now I think it, more important, I think now it's a matter of like whatever people are doing in terms of, like you're saying, opening a restaurant and trying to create a style. I think it has more to do with the efficiency. I mean, everything is about efficiency now. And I think is minimalism, of course, is part of, is back again a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, and just trying to be very...
Well, clean. I think clean is it.
Clean.
Minimalism in the sense that it's clean.
Yes.
Well, I think that goes back to how inundated we are with so much, and we want to just kind of slow down a bit and to not be so, I think, washed with so many options that we kind of just want to, you know, like the menu, the way
it's not,
like,
it's not a great diner.
Yeah. or a theme park. Stressful. Or a Chinese restaurant.
Or a theme park. No, we're not in a theme park.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But some people haven't seen Club Monaco. Some people haven't seen Tartar. And I think the trends still kind of happen in waves because everyone should enjoy something as different
Kung Pao shrimp four ways.
Well, it's true. I mean,
there's a difference with being original and then sharing that and then kind of not moving to the next, but having things just naturally take their course.
Yeah, and everything is very, like, it's not going back to the 90s minimalism, you know what I mean? It's not everything white, but it's definitely very edited. Mm-hmm, and it's a matter of, it's an issue of, like, even budget. I mean,
right, sure. Yeah.
Can you really invest that much money into your property this time?
Well, also, it's funny because, you know, if you talk to any top designers, it's expensive to be minimalist. It's expensive to be sparse. And it's when there's places that look empty that are just empty, right?
Yeah.
There's places that look perspectively empty and have the texture, maybe
the warmth,
and the texture and the wall coverings are all specific, but it's not like, you know, there's a moose head coming out of the, you know, you know what I mean? But there's a place for that too. So, you know, remember the Raccoon Lodge, the original Raccoon Lodge?
Totally, totally.
That place was amazing. And, and our studio here, you know, I've got Max over here on the wall, you know, but he's classic.
I like Rex better.
Rex.
Yeah. And I think it's a big difference. Like you're saying, like if you have a whole room full of taxidermia, because when you create a new project, you drove in some road up in, you know, in Massachusetts or somewhere there, and you find a whole truck full of that, and you say, you know what, this is going to be it.
Yeah.
Then I would say, you know what, you're very smart. You did something smart. But if you have to invest that much money to replicate that in the city, I said, then you're doing a bad investment there.
Yeah.
So it depends. I mean, I always tell people, find what's original and keep it real. I mean, that's is that
reflect? But there's also the sense of change. I mean, I remember being in China, where we were staying at the St. Regis, and we went around the corner, and there was this, like, it was like someone had, you know, Dorothy in Kansas had dropped this Tex-Mex place in the middle of China. Mm-hmm. And I was like, holy shit, like, it had the burnished wood, it had everything. And I talked to the owner who happened to come out, and she said, yeah, we took over 1,000 photographs, and we replicated this board by board, stool by stool, menu item by menu item, and they dropped it in, and the place is doing like $100,000 a week,
and it's in China.
It's killing. And you know who goes there? Expats. Yeah. Every expat, not one Chinese person walks in there. People go, holy shit, that's a Texas. I know exactly what that place is. And they walk in, and they're like, and it's maybe 75% of the flavor or whatever they expect, but who cares? They're getting their, you know, their Elvis platter,
totally,
you know, and they're loving it.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, like, formulas are hard to, I think in general, a lot of entrepreneurs and people in this business have a sort of like a nose for it. And I think what I can tell you is that what's happening now, everything is becoming, what I used to hate that word, experiential, but it really is becoming very experiential now. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like, you don't just have good food, because sometimes you have great food and you have horrible service.
Sure, you have to appeal to all the different. Yeah.
And before, you used to say, "No, I don't care about the service is shitty, but the food is so good."
Right.
And I remember myself being okay with
it. Can't get away with that anymore.
You can't do it anymore. Yeah. You can't do it anymore.
And now, so it's the whole thing is changing. So I'm kind of happy because everybody's more educated. So true value shows up, and I'm all for value. That's how I live, anyways.
Before we have to close up the show, is there anything that we want to talk about regarding Baja?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay, all I really know.
Which sounds pretty dreamy right now. I have to say.
So where is this property going to be? So I can.
It's right at the foothills of Valle del Carmen, which is, I believe that's,
it's about an hour south of San Diego.
Yes. And it's right at the foothills
killing it.
Exactly. It's going to be right at the foothills of the wine country. So the idea that we're trying to do is to co-brand with some of the vineyards and trying to promote some of the Mexican products out here also. But that particular property is very involved with, it's going to be a lot of wine pairing and wine tastings, and we're trying to become that place that is not necessarily, it's going to be very friendly and approachable, but we're going to try to bring all the wine culture down there together. So we're trying to create a movement there. That's why
they have a long, long history there. I mean, before there was vinifera planted in the Northern California area, you know, the Franciscan monks had come over and they had planted outcroppings from Italy, Spain, primarily, and some French stuff that was commingled with the Italian and Spanish grapes. And they basically had the lock and trade on alcohol production in that part of the world. And it was for their own use, obviously. And during the various prohibition areas, you know, before our real prohibition in the 30s, the only place you could get quality grapes or quality wine was from the church.
Wow.
And so the original plantings of all the wine were done in Baja, and that's a lot of people don't realize that. So I'm really waiting to see this area come back. I mean you're going to have trouble because it's going to be, you know, there's not a lot of coastal breeze on certain parts of the escarpment where their wine is grown. So you're going to have a lot of these thicker skinned, really heavy reds. You know, obviously can't grow white wine down there.
And Brian, the best thing about them not only bringing the plants as well and growing the wine to share, but they were actually, these missionaries as well, were here to teach them how to farm the land and how to grow the wine and the grapes. So,
well, they took the land and then they taught them how to farm it.
They stole it and then right and fired.
Right.
So and had no choice but to carry on the tradition.
Correct.
So thank goodness.
Yes. But no, but you're right, Camille, because a lot of people think, oh, well, the wine business is in Northern California. It starts somehow from Oakland and goes north. Well, the reality is it started, you know, way south of L.A., and it's a San Diego-based, entertainment thing. And it really could be the next big thing. But I wonder, and this is not, it's kind of like when Chile came and Argentina came to this market, they were only perceived as value wines. But I think domestically, the Mexican wines could be a real boon for not only Mexican growers market. And farmers, but also for all the southern states could, you know, start to really to benefit from that. I mean, do you think that you could sell a Mexican wine, Camille, on your list for how much?
That's a great question. We're actually in discussions right now over that. People ask about them, and we should have one on the list. I can't. That's something that again is going to change. But I think now the market's actually ready for it. Before, I don't think you'd really have to do a hand sell to get out there.
Mexican wine used to be called Corona.
I could sell Corona. I could do that. I'd say you could do some added value in there for a 30 to 40 range. I'm sure that could happen.
That'd be a good push.
Yeah.
Well, I venture to say the people who are going to want to seek out Mexican wines would actually spend a little bit more than that for a Mexican wine, too.
I'm not sure about that because I think that the people, having been to Mexico City many, many times, in Mexico City, the well-to-do Mexicans are drinking French wine.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think if they create the right infrastructure to, you know, the whole import of the, because I think that you're saying what happened in Chile, and I remember growing up and we either drank, I'm from Venezuela, so for us was like either a gray Bordeaux or single malt. That was sort of like, it was like a luxury to drink in any sort of spirit or wine. But nowadays, it's the opposite. So like how much value can you get out of a bottle? What's a great bottle that it would be a great value, but a great wine. Mm-hmm, so I think that's happening a lot with the South American wines now. They're developing and they're becoming better and better.
Absolutely.
So I think hopefully that happens with the Mexican
soil.
Well,
they've had a lot of investment down there as well.
Exactly.
And so that's just sort of thing that takes some time to...
I think with the wealth that Mexico kind of has, also, I don't think it would be a big deal for them, a big issue once they get into it, mm-hmm. to start
Especially
investing.
Some Mexican pride, and there would be like totally. You know, some nationalism. They'd want to support their products. And so I think...
Brian, do you know of any... I'm sorry.
I don't. I don't know of any that I would buy.
Do you know of any California wine producers or wineries that are investing in maybe
I do. Things? I do.
In these
I do.
Properties?
They're not, Gallo is making significant investments down there. And I heard that the Kendall Jackson crew, since Jess's untimely death, the new management is considering investing down there as well because mm-hmm. they just don't have any more places to buy.
Right.
There's no more property.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But hey, you know, this has been an incredible conversation that we should continue on another show. And I want to invite you guys back for sure.
Thank you.
And Aaron, I'll let you take us out there, Queen.
Oh, all right then. Well, this is, Omar Hernandez from Hotel Raducano and Camille Broderick, also serving as a sommelier. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week to talk about port and port cocktails just in time for Valentine's Day. cheers. Enjoy your week and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.